Hello, and welcome to the second year of the Critical Ecologies podcast series, which is a series of interviews with postgraduate students in the geography department. This year we have more students taking the module in spatial justice than last year. So there's 11 students from anthropology and media studies and sociology as well as geography. And we'll be having interviews with all 11 over the next few weeks. So today we have Caitlin Armstrong, who's first up, and Caitlin is from the anthropology department doing the MA in anthropology, and her work is very timely and relevant with what's going on in the news at the moment on the heritage of bogs. And specifically, the hurting heritage of bogs, which we'll get to explaining in a little bit. So, welcome, Caitlin.
Thank you.
I guess the way we usually start is to sort of allow you introduce yourself a little bit and talk about how you got interested in the topic of bogs.
Thanks, and absolutely. So I guess a few years ago, as I was about to graduate with a BA in anthropology in the US, I became interested in what an anthropological perspective could bring to climate action and in seeking environmental and social justice. But I wasn't really sure how. And then I guess fast forward a bit, I came back to Ireland in 2020. I did a bit of time at NUIG during my bachelor's as well. And then whenever I was here in 2020, I got stuck as a result of COVID. And so I guess do something with all this extra time. I started volunteering, and one of the organizations I started volunteering with was Ontoshka. And it was here at Ontoshka that I began to understand more and more about the ecological issues in the Irish context. And then I decided to pursue the MA in anthropology and development to explore some of these intersections that I was engaging with. And at the onset of this course, I started working with the organization formally. And as a result, I became wrapped up in a climate heritage, which is the employment of arts and culture and heritage to address the climate crisis. And I also became absorbed in a hurting heritage or a heritage that hurts following a talk from Dr. Gabrielle Weihart in the anthropology department. And then your spatial justice module introduced me to ideas and concepts that I hadn't considered, and to more geographical research that was taking place in Ireland. For example, I became really inspired by Vincenza Siderfice's work in the Sperrins, which ultimately led me to where I am now. So I'm exploring places or spaces where planning heritage, particularly that hurting heritage and resistance collide. And specifically, I'm exploring bogs as a living intersection of these three elements.
Great, thanks so much. And that term herding heritage is really interesting and provocative one. So I guess a good place to go next is to ask you to explain that a little bit to listeners who I'm sure are not that familiar with it.
So heritage itself, I guess, takes on a lot of different meanings. And there are certain heritages that are discussed more frequently, especially in Ireland. There's cultural heritage, which is, I guess, more encompassing and refers to both tangible and intangible elements of a culture, such as important sites or language or traditions. And then under this umbrella, there is a built heritage, for example, in reference to the built landscape, buildings and monuments. Natural heritage, such as culturally important landscapes, Ireland's bogs would be included here. And then this historical heritage, which I'm employing to think about historic events or processes that are having a lasting impact. And of course, there's so much overlap here. There are no strict borders, really. And I think the actual definition of heritage is just the range of various things inherited or passed down from generation to the next, whether this be at the national scale or within a family. So in thinking about Ireland, a question might be, what has Ireland inherited, which leads me to a hurting heritage. And as I mentioned, I borrowed a heritage that hurts from Dr. Gabrielle Wyhart, but I found an interesting duality in the Irish context when I started to encounter how heritage is molded in relation to the environment. So, for example, how or why intensive dairying is being lamented to be a part of Ireland's heritage and therefore something to protect. So heritage can hurt, from at least from my research, in two ways. Heritage can hurt through a historical event that inflicts lasting emotion or has lasting impact. And heritage can hurt through processes of using heritage to advocate against or to continue or to promote bad practice. And then I've sort of developed two questions stemming from that. So one being, what are the ecological implications, such as colonialism, for Ireland's history for bogs? How is heritage molded in discourses of turf cutting, and what are the knowledges involved here?
Fascinating, yeah, because I guess it's you know, people usually think about heritage as something positive or benign, you know, at worst.
Yeah.
But the idea of hurting heritage, the idea that these things that we inherit, that people hold on to, or society holds on to, are not necessarily good. And I guess this then takes us to the kind of empirical focus of your work, you know, for the class, which is on bogs, and, you know, why it's so pertinent to today with some of the debates, and at least some of the ways the debates are framed, the media and so on, around turf cutting. But I guess turf cutting isn't the only thing happening in the bogs. There's lots there, and maybe you could just say a little bit about what drew you to the bogs and bog ecologies and bog heritage.
Yeah, I guess this is something I've been trying to figure out myself as well. I'm originally from Tennessee, and the closest thing to a bog I would have engaged with growing up would be swamps in the southern U.S. But of course, these two landscapes are very different. They have different climates, they have different water sources, and they support different forms of life as a result. But I suppose the reason I was drawn to bogs, apart from the space that I work in, is the employment of their livingness or aliveness here in Ireland. You know, bogs aren't just sites of resistance, but they are alive and they're fighting for life in their own right. The discourses I have been that I've become particularly drawn to are those that consider more than human beings. And so I've been asking questions like, how do we relate to bogs? What can thinking with bogs as a living subject engender? And I think movements like the Rights of Nature or the Right to Roam are very interesting here, because they point out that we've become observers of nature. We seem to have lost, or seem to be losing our curiosity for it or our wonder for it. And we forget that we're actually a part of nature. So I guess that this living aspect is what has really drawn me to bog landscapes in Ireland.
Yeah. I also have done some work on bogs, or do work with the bogs, and there is something, you know, and many people have said it, and I guess it's you know, in poetry and art as well, it's something about the bogs that is, you know, there are a lot of contradictions there that are quite compelling as well. So, I mean, maybe just to follow up on some of what you're saying there about the kind of human and the more than human, or the social and the ecological, and, you know, the sort of, I guess, conflicts over the bogs, or at least one conflict over the bogs historically, has been about those trying to preserve the bogs as these, you know, sites of fragile and abundant, non-human life, the kinds of biodiversity and so on. And then on the other, the bogs have been, particularly since the 50s, 60s, the industrialization of the bogs have been a source of employment. And they, that type of work, the mining of peat, has been central to, communities, not just in terms of providing employment, but like social infrastructures and, sort of social life. And these things are obviously in conflict, because the draining of the bogs and extraction of peat at that scale is not compatible with a living bogs. And so I wonder if there's any way, in the same way that in heritage and in the work that you do with Antashka, I mean, there's often sort of built heritage, and then there's like natural heritage, these kinds of dualisms that are maybe really not helpful in terms of how we move towards thinking about, bogs, bog life as being, supportive of human work and human communities, as well as being supportive of non-human communities. And there needs to be this sort of multi-species or more than human convergence and conviviality. And so I wonder, is that a direction that you've been moving, and you talk about the literature you've been looking at. Is that something that you think is important, or
I definitely think a multi-species approach is really important. It's definitely a direction I've been going in, and it's something I've just started reading more about as well. I guess something to mention in relation to your last comment and question as well is, and it's something that you and Pat Brody have been exploring, is that we've been engaging with bogs for thousands of years. And they're not untouched landscapes. All the artifacts and that have been preserved and that are found on bogs attest to this. And as you and Pat Brody point out, is that community-based projects that involve a range of different players offer ways of thinking about bogs that are outside of this colonial mindset. But I guess I'll explore that the coloniality a bit as well. The colonial mindset or the colonial way of thinking about or using bogs is definitely something I've been thinking about recently. And considering colonialism, maybe the question becomes, how are we asserting dominance over bogs? How are we transforming the value of bogs to meet our own ends? And maybe an example can be illustrated through Bor Nimona. So Bor Nimona is a semi-state company that was created in 1946 by the Turf Development Act, and its purpose was to provide economic benefit for the Midlands, as well as to provide energy security for Ireland. And it did so through large-scale turf cutting. In 2018 or 2019, Bor Nimona ceased all turf cutting, or peat mining, as it's sometimes referred to, and rebranded in 2021 as a climate solutions company. And having rebranded, Bor Nimona now seeks to transform these wasted landscapes of cutaway bogs, or in other words, the bogs that were drained during the last 70 or 80 years within their land bank into sites of renewable forms of energy. This includes data centers, wind farms, but also by rewetting the bogs for natural carbon sinks. So bogs have become a source of value through energy, whether it's non-renewable or renewable, as well as a source of value through their ability to store carbon. And as you and Pat Brody argue, or are arguing, colonial mindsets about bogs, they remain prevalent, and they are removing alternative ways of living and relating to bogs. And maybe questions here about for whom become really important, because these renewable forms of energy are not going to our homes, but they're going to large corporations.
Thanks. I wonder, and this is me, you know, just being a bit devil's advocate too, because I know you've referenced there the work that I've done with Pat, and we do argue exactly what you've said. But I wonder for most people, when they think about the bogs and colonialism or colonial mindsets, you know, that's a phase of history, say. That's the sort of when Ireland was a colony of England's. And so, you know, and when Ireland got its independence and Borna Mona was set up, originally, I guess its predecessor in the 1930s, that was a post-colonial period. You know, we were free of the English, and there was a sense of sort of national self-determination and development of resources for Irish people. So there's a jarring there in terms of continuing to see the work of Borna Mona and what it did in the Midlands, which was not colonial, at least in a kind of economic sense, because it was about developing those communities. It was about developing those places in a way that was of benefit to workers and their communities and so on. So maybe I'd ask you to say a little bit more then about what you mean by the colonial mindset, because for most people, you know, what Borna Mona did with the bogs was very different to what the English did or tried to do with the bogs. So what is it that's consistent in terms of how you're framing it? And up until today, with Borna Mona kind of rebranding as Climate Solutions, so we're talking about very different, I guess, sets of economic relationships, very different kinds of political cultures, you know, spanning this 300 years. But you're arguing that there's something that is consistent in terms of how the bogs are seen. So maybe you could just maybe specify that a little bit. So,
yeah. So I've been reading about colonialism in the Irish context. It's a book by Robbie McVeigh and Bill Rolston. And in their book, they're arguing that, or they make it clear that colonialism is continuing to structure life in Ireland in profound ways. It's something of the past, but it's continuing to shape the present. And when you look around, it's really evident, especially when you consider the Irish landscape. I guess, for example, Brett Clark and John Foster. And exploring Marx's metabolic rift or the rift of ecological and social balances, argue that colonialism in Ireland resulted in the robbery of nature. So for example, the movement of enclosure, which is the transformation of land held in common into privately owned land, has helped transform nature into capital. And here, lands held or open for common use were deemed to possess no value and were made profitable by cultivating them and making them spaces for crops or turning them into pastures. In the 1800s, the colonial regime transformed Ireland into an agricultural society. So Ireland was first positioned as ideal for crops, specifically for grains and potatoes, and then later it was positioned as ideal for pasturage, all of which met the needs of empire when it commanded. And there's a particular quote by Jesse Goldstein that I think is really powerful here, that the power of nature became the power over nature. And I think this describes that robbery of nature and how colonial and capitalistic systems have transformed the environment, and this is still seen today. Enclosure is still visible today through fences and hedges, walls. They all line the landscape. They're enclosing and confining nature.
I mean, I think that there's a key thing that you touched on there, and referencing Jesse Goldstein's great article on Terra Economica and waste and enclosure, is the bogs, the kind of the dualism of waste and value, and about how the bogs, there's a kind of a constant trope over the last, at least going back to the 18th century, of seeing the bogs as wasteland. Or, I mean, even you talked about Tennessee and the swamps. There's a lot similar there. The swamps are seen as this sort of unproductive landscape or unproductive ecology, and there are various different projects going back to draining it for agricultural land or forestry or peat mining, which are always trying to, like you say, assert a certain kind of, productive. Set of technologies and plans and projects to sort of extract value from the land, from the landscapes, the bog landscapes. But there's something about bog landscapes that are also resistant to that, as well. And I wonder if you could, to hone in a little bit then on more specific things. You talk a little bit about three bog-related projects in your essay. And I thought it was interesting because they're quite different bog-related projects. I think, when people in Ireland think about the bogs, if they ever think about the bogs, they probably have quite they probably have quite they either situate it in the Midlands and the kind of Bord na Mona type bogs, large-scale extraction, or they think about kind of the West Coast, the raised bogs. Or the blanket bogs, I should say, and the kind of more traditional sort of pictures. And you touched on three kinds of projects which, maybe I think challenge that a little bit. And I was wondering if you could just talk about those three projects and maybe why the geography of bogs matters when we talk about bogs, that we have to be quite specific because you have different kinds of, again, different kinds of political cultures coming to play depending on where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely find the resistance to some of these things very interesting. So the three examples that I gave included Antashka, included Friends of the RD Bog, as well as groups and organizations in Leitrim. So I guess the first example surrounded Antashka and Slieve Bay. So Antashka owns land and trust around Ireland, including just over 2,000 acres of Slieve Bay in counties Monaghan and Tyrone. And this area is home to blanket bog habitat. And some there's a lot there's several notable community-led projects, including or here at this site. Including Slieve Bay Adventures, Boots and Bogs Border Tours, and the community-led hotel, which has been running now for almost 22 years. And I think these projects, they're really interesting because they illustrate alternative ways of seeing and using bogs and land more generally, because the site isn't enclosed. It's really community-oriented. And then I guess the second example I drew upon was or revolved around Friends of the RD Bog. I've only recently discovered the group, but they're a community-led environmental group aiming to protect and preserve RD Bog, which is located in Louth. I attended their recent webinar. Called The Rights of Nature on the Island of Ireland. And I was really struck by a couple of different elements that surfaced during the discussion. First is the fact that when the group talks about the rights of nature, they mean nature that includes humans. And this is really interestingly symbolized through their St. Patrick's curly costume. I don't know if anyone has seen it, but it's really beautiful and powerful as well. And secondly, so the rights of nature, it's been gaining traction in Europe recently, and In Ireland, Donegal County Council adopted the Rights of Nature earlier this year. However, friends of the RDBOG, they're not waiting for the Rights of Nature to be written into law. They're going to declare it themselves on RDBOG, which is really interesting. And I guess the third example I drew upon was based in, were involved the community groups in Leitrim. Our spatial justice class took a day trip to Leitrim, and we met with individuals from the Kiltiquahar Heritage Center, the Organic Center, Save Leitrim, and Save Doe Mountain. It was a jam-packed day, but it was full of rich community knowledge. So 20% of Leitrim is covered in forestry plantations, of which implications are many, such as the lack of life that these forestry plantations support, both in terms of biodiversity and for the communities. It's deeply felt that the state regards the county as only good for trees, as a sort of wasteland to curb emissions produced elsewhere in the country. For example, dairy farming in the southeast. And associated with these issues is the proposal for 18 more wind turbines to join the three that are already standing on Doe Mountain. The catch, though, is that the turbines will be standing on bog land, and the concrete and the roads that will be needed for the turbines will drain the bog. And this will then have an impact on water quality through landslides or uproot homes of species that live on the bog, such as the hen harrier. And for my research, I guess this is an example of where planning becomes so important. You know, the importance of assessing the environmental impact of a development, or the impact that a development is going to have. And I guess the second part of your question about geography, and why geography matters when talking about bogs. You mentioned the different types of bogs, the raised bogs or blanket bogs, and that's really important, to, of course. And that, I mean, they will, these, the bogs will support different types of life, or different types of life will be more prevalent on the bogs, on one or the other. But I guess in terms of geography, scale is also really important. I'm definitely reminded of these groups that are located in different areas of Ireland, and the ways that they're engaging with the bogs. But other scales of local and global, or local and national, or rural and urban, these scales definitely become important, especially, I guess, when considering recent debates and the like.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, when you were in Leitrim on that field trip, I mean, and you would have walked, so, you know, the point you're making there is that the forestry, a lot of that forestry and the wind farms that are being built, wind turbines, are often built on bog surfaces, bog ecologies, and they have effects. These types of large-scale forestry or large-scale wind energy infrastructures, they have the potential at least to damage these bogs. And I think it's an interesting point that you know, some of those that you met, the people that you met who are trying, you know, are resisting these developments at the scale that they're happening, it's because they care about the bogs. And I think that's it's interesting, because what you have, again, going back to your point about scale, is on the one hand, you have these very ambitious targets for renewable energy that Ireland has by 2030. And that's very much sort of being hitched to the idea of large-scale renewables. But large-scale renewables are being built in ways and in places that not only impact humans, which is often, you know, what gets the cover, but also local ecologies.
Yeah.
And so you've got this sort of a contradiction between different kinds of environmental care. So I wonder, I wonder if going back to the point, we shouldn't, we can't continue to imagine, or we shouldn't continue to imagine bogs without people. But likewise, we have to protect the bogs by stopping certain types of, human economic activity which damages them. So, what are some of the projects? And you've mentioned a couple of projects, but what other kinds of maybe ideas are there, things that you've come across where there is a possibility for, local forms of employment, livelihood, that can sustain, forms of human life, social life, as well as sustaining the ecologies of the bogs and the living bogs.
I guess what immediately comes to mind is some of the community-led projects at Slave Bay that I sort of touched upon, like the community-led hotel. It's community-owned and community-led. I guess in terms of replicating that, it would take a lot of voluntary manpower, it would take a lot of financial support.
I wonder, does that get to the crux of it though, in a way? And this is something that's coming out in the literature too, is that a lot of the work that's required to repair or restore or make bogs lively again is not work that is going to be it's not making a product. So you can have ecotourism, and that's at a certain level, you can have an income, but like you say, there's not enough, there's not enough to go around. But maybe the kind of work that is required, which is labor intensive, can be labor intensive, the kinds of work which is even about conservation, people living near these bogs, loving these bogs, that's a form of work. And maybe the kinds of ideas we have about wage labor, the ideas we have about remuneration, the type of labor or work that deserves to be paid for, maybe that's what needs to be changed. And also the idea that that will have to come from the public, from the state. It's that people are paid, maybe even a basic, there's talk of a basic conservation income for people who live close to these. And maybe that's what it kind of boils down to, as opposed to, again, thinking about how the bogs can be profitable by selling carbon services or renewable energy or, yeah. But the community-led hotel sounds really fascinating. I think it's forgotten that some of these projects have been running. You said, how long did you say that it had been running for?
For almost 22 years, I think this summer.
Yeah, I mean, some of these projects are not like new. It's not just because there's climate urgency and that these things are in the media or the news. People have been doing stuff for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's worth paying attention to what they're doing. Are there any last points or things we didn't cover that you'd like to say about even maybe where you'd like to go in the future with your work?
I guess I'm really interested in that last point about how different ways of caring and restoring bogs, and how people are already doing this, and how we could replicate or think about more or different ways of caring and restoring bogs. And I guess the resistive nature of bogs themselves, just the multitude of forms of resistance at bogs, not just as a community, but just that multi-species approach, I guess, in terms of resistance.
It sounds like very valuable work to go in, and I really hope you do continue it after the masters.
Thanks.
Okay, I'll stop it there. Thanks so much, Caitlin.
Yeah, thank you.